Hi, and welcome to Forecast, a show about climate science and climate scientists. Your host is Nature's Editor for Climate Science. Today's guest is Kevin Antiochidis from the University of Arizona. Today we're talking about climate and civilization interactions, the golden toad, tree rings, and volcanoes.
That was Forecast's special guest announcer, Vonnen White, my five-year-old son. Greetings from Bethel, Maine, where we have a few editions coming up of Shedcast. Thanks to Jennifer Hertzberg for the suggestion on the name change. Yeah, we're up here in Maine. We made it out here eventually. We traveled from the Bay Area, left at like 4:30 in the morning, got out to San Francisco International Airport, where our flight was variously delayed and then not delayed. We got out to New York JFK, where it turned out that our initial connection had been canceled. We got booked onto like a 10:45 p.m. flight that was like a five-hour delay, more or less, and then that got delayed until 4:20 a.m., at which point we got into a hotel, booked a hotel through my credit card, got to the hotel, and they were like, oh, no, we don't have a reservation for you. And it turned out that the Chase booking people had actually made the reservation for July, not for June. So that was like a wasted hour there. Well, by that time, fortunately, our flight had been moved back up till 2:45 a.m. So we're like, oh, that's not so bad. Get back to the airport. Turns out the flight had actually, by that time, been canceled. So two cancellations in a row with a five-year-old who was doing, it turns out, amazingly well in the airport. And then we're like, you know, there's been two cancellations. The next flight's at 7:45 a.m. We should probably take up Amelia Chavanel's suggestion and just get a rental car. So we did that. That took forever. And then at that point, I was so tired, I actually tried to drive out of the lot in the wrong rental car, got the right one, and promptly rammed that into the curb by the checkout kiosk, but eventually got in the road at 2:45 a.m., drove from JFK up to Portland, Maine, where I met my father-in-law, and we kind of crashed out for a couple hours, and finally made it to Bethel, Maine at 3 o'clock in the afternoon the next day. So it was quite a trip. Then we were there for a day. Then we went out to Winter Harbor, Maine, which is just across from Bar Harbor and Mount Desert Island in Acadia National Park, and hung out there with my father and his wife for, it was like four nights. Had a great time out there. Ate a ton of lobster rolls. Had a good time. Now back in Maine, podcasting from the farmhouse. And then in just a couple of days, we're off to do the Presidential Traverse in the White Mountains, which should be hopefully a lot of fun. Then down to Boston for three nights, and then to New York for the WCRP meeting on sea level rise. So it's a pretty busy time out here. And my goodness, I've been on Twitter with Jacqueline Gill and talking about the current tick season. I'm like such a complete lightweight. I know that everyone up here is having to deal with this all the time, but I just find it to be incredibly creepy. I feel like a complete lightweight when I'm dealing with this, but we've had several ticks on my son and on our bodies. It's like flicking them off. They're in the house. You sort of wake up with them crawling over your body. It's definitely an adjustment from the Bay Area, but I love it. It's like an incredibly beautiful view up here. The weather is stunning and having a good time. Back on the science side, I'm interviewing today Kevin Antiochidis, like Vonnen said at the beginning, and I've been trying to get Kevin and his wife, Jessica Tierney, on the show for some time. They've been extremely busy, but did manage to record Kevin for today's interview. Then I have Jess coming up soon. I might post the interview with Julien Emilier, who I also have recorded before that, but we'll see. I wanted to talk to Jess and to Kevin, both because they're doing extremely interesting, complementary, but quite different research on paleoclimate. Jess tends to go deeper back in time and use more of the organic geochemical proxies, while Kevin is working usually on tree rings and Delta Wetina tree rings, things like that, but has really much broader interests. And I guess that's what really struck me about today's interview, was just the number of different fields that Kevin and his colleagues are bringing together It's kind of remarkable, and you see that in submissions to Nature, that it's becoming increasingly uncommon to just have a pure dendrochronology or dendroclimatology paper, and now it's coming together with things like historical records and archaeology, climate modeling, more careful treatment of the forward modeling of proxies. So it's tremendously exciting to see that on the editorial side. And I think that's the main theme of the interview, is sort of the connections that are now being brought together in Kevin's research. Hopefully by the end of this, you'll have a better idea of where this field of late Holocene paleoclimate research is right now, and the kind of big questions that they're trying to address, and a lot of which involves climate and civilization interactions, which I hadn't really expected, but that's the way the conversation went. And with that, let's get on to it. My talk with Kevin Anchaitis. Vonnen, any final words about the interview with Kevin?
There's a really good part about Jesuits.
Kevin Anchaitis from the University of Arizona, thank you for coming on Forecast today.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I was talking to Kaustubh Thirumalai a little while ago, and he was saying that when he was thinking about coming to go to graduate school in the U.S. from India, that, you know, a lot of Indians who are thinking about doing this have this perception that the U.S. is more or less the same thing all over the place, and they don't consider they don't know about the geographical variations. And looking through your scientific and also your sort of personal career, it strikes me that you spent a lot of time both in the northeastern U.S., born in Schenectady, New York, but also in a lot of your professional career at Lamont and at Woods Hole, but then a lot of it also for your PhD and now as a professor in Arizona. So how would you contrast the big chunks of the Northeast that you've lived in and Arizona, both in terms of the social environment and the scientific culture in those two places?
Yeah, I mean, I spent my first 18 years entirely living in a relatively small town in upstate New York. And then from there sort of started this, you know, tour of the country. I haven't gotten to see much of the Pacific Northwest yet.
Okay.
But everywhere else. And then on to Washington, D.C. So moving from this small town right into this, well, it felt like a big city at the time, before I went to New York, and then down to Tennessee, to Knoxville, Tennessee, which was, you know, obviously a complete change from having been in D.C. for the previous 5 years.
Right, you were at Georgetown, right, for your bachelor's?
Yeah, I was at Georgetown. So I grew up in upstate New York, and Schenectady and Niskayuna, which is actually the even smaller town where my parents lived, is right there where General Electric is, where General Electric's research and development lab is.
Your dad was there, wasn't he, as an engineer?
Yeah. So my parents moved to Schenectady because my dad was going to work at General Electric after he got his bachelor's in physics at St. Lawrence University in upstate New York.
Okay.
At the time, you know, General Electric had a much larger presence in Schenectady, and they actually had a program where you could start to work for General Electric and then also get your master's degree at Union College. That was the motivation for ending up in Schenectady, and they're still there to this day.
So even though, are they both retired now, or are they still working?
So my dad retired a few years ago from General Electric. So one of these sort of careers we think of in the past, where someone starts at one company and finishes at that same company, an idea that I think is, you know, becoming less common, unfortunately. And my mom is still a Spanish teacher at a Catholic high school in Schenectady as well, and mm-hmm. not retired yet, still teaching. So yeah, they're still there to this day.
And Schenectady and this other smaller town you mentioned, did it really feel like you were growing up in like an isolated company town? What was the vibe like when you were there? Was it pretty homogeneous racially, or was it a fairly diverse environment? What was it like?
With more perspective now, I realize that it wasn't so diverse. the one thing that mediated against that, though, was that the General Electric's research and development and Knowles Atomic Power Lab and were big draws for people with PhDs coming from all over the world, engineers, scientists, and so that helped give our community a more more diverse mix than it might have otherwise just by geography alone. So I actually grew up in this wonderful environment of, you know, people that were really families, you know, and as well as the parents and of my friends who were just really engaged, really very had traveled, that had, you know, been around the world or were working on these scientific things. Yeah. I don't know how much I was really aware of that, but I think it sort of seeped in, and it was definitely a culture of sort of research and discovery. At least, you know, looking back, I realize that now.
One of my other podcast guests, Saul Shung, who's an economist, was saying that, you know, his parents were also academics, and he never knew that anybody ever got up before 10 a.m. or worked during the summers. Like, it sounded like a pretty good lifestyle. Growing up in that environment, surrounded by engineers, people from all over the world, highly educated people, did getting into science always seem like a good thing to do for you, or did you go through a period where you were seriously considering other options?
Oh yeah, no, I actually, you know, came to back to science, if you will, pretty much accidentally. So I went to Niskayuna High School. Again, didn't really realize that we had this wonderful. Maybe didn't fully realize that we had this wonderful school with all sorts of opportunities and really good teachers and difficult classes. One of the funny things about, and I don't think it's still this way, but if you took advanced placement science in New York State back when I was a high school student, the way you got into that track was to, in your first year in high school, skip into advanced placement biology. What did you skip? You skipped earth science. You skipped geology.
Yeah, it's not necessarily a good thing, is it?
No, it's a terrible thing, in fact. And so you know, then you do biology, chemistry, physics, and then your last year, you know, you can do something else. So, and now they have environmental science, and there's other options. But it's kind of funny. Like, I was definitely not thinking that I was headed for a science track. I was really interested in history, and I also got to take an economics class in high school. That was where I was headed when I started to look at colleges. I was really looking at history or political science or international affairs. Economics, those were all the things that were on my radar. I don't even think it even crossed my mind as I was trying to decide where to go for college that I was going to do much more science.
And I guess I would think of Georgetown as being stronger in those areas you mentioned than in environmental science or in geosciences. Is that what drew you there?
Yeah. So I, when I was applying to schools, I was looking for these sort of history, but also international opportunities. So, you know, growing up in a household where my mom was teaching and Spanish, and where I learned Spanish at a younger age, I'd gotten to travel with her over to Spain when she took students to Spain. I was already sort of thinking internationally. And then I wanted some, you know, history coursework. And I was sort of interested in sort of programs that were beyond the sort of, well, you're going to get a bachelor's in history or a bachelor's in economics. And the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown, which is one of the, at the time, five undergraduate colleges at Georgetown, just totally grabbed my attention. This very intensive first 2 years of economics and history, political science, theology, because it's a Jesuit school, philosophy. And I just thought that was great. I was super excited to get this really strong background in social sciences and humanities, and have this sort of track towards some kind of international career. So that was my thinking when I was applying to school. And I was also a lightweight rower. I rowed crew in high school. And I'd be lying if I didn't say that the fact that Georgetown's lightweights were going to be Division I the year that I started, that was at least factored into my decision. So.
But you did not stay in those sort of foreign service areas. You did go to Costa Rica, but you switched to environmental science. What kicked off that switch for you?
Yeah. So School of Foreign Service, you know, it has this very intensive first 2 years. You have almost no latitude in what to take. But while I was sort of taking my history and economics and philosophy, my intention, which was to do some kind of international law, that sort of started to fade. I decided that maybe I didn't want to be a lawyer. And this was, you know, a moment where I was like, oh, well, this was always what I was planning on doing. and it's not so simple to just sort of hop around programs at Georgetown once you're in the School of Foreign Service. And I love the School of Foreign Service. I wouldn't trade that experience for anything.
Is the curriculum fairly fixed?
For the first 2 years especially. And then something like 75% of the students go abroad for at least part of their junior year, you know, in fitting with the program. And so, and you know, that can make it tough to get required classes and stuff. So at least the first couple of years, there's relatively little flexibility. One thing that you do get to do, everybody gets to do, is after those first 2 years is you get to choose a track within the School of Foreign Service. And so they had security and diplomacy or history and diplomacy. You could do regional studies. And at the time, what was a small major, and it's not a small major anymore, was the science, technology, and international affairs.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And it was about 30 students, I think, when I started. And now I think it's the second largest major, you know, which I think speaks to where a lot of sort of law and international policy and things are going in the world around Georgetown. And what they do is, at the beginning of your second year, you have a day, it's Parents Weekend, where you get to go around and listen to lectures by faculty that are within those different tracks. And so I went to a lecture by Tim Beach, who is a professor of geography now at the University of Texas in Austin, but at the time was at Georgetown. And his talk to, you know, sophomore SFS students, School of Foreign Service students, was about his work in Belize and Yucatan, looking at these ancient Maya sites, trying to understand how they had managed their environment, how the environment had changed. They were exploring this site that they thought was an ancient Maya port. This totally grabbed me. It recaptured my interest in science, but it also fit into that interest in history, right? I was going to get to do, if I majored in this science, technology, and international affairs, I could do history, but it would be sort of environmental history or, you know, human history, but with this, within this environmental context. And there were two other big influences on me. One was John McNeil, who is still at Georgetown, a really well-known environmental historian, written a number of books. And so he taught one of my required classes, and it was basically sort of a history of the meeting of the new and the old world. And so Columbian exchange and modifications of landscapes. And so that had also really sunk in. And I don't know if I had seen it in a scientific view, but I was starting to say, wow, there's this aspect of history that is very much embedded in these landscapes. And then the third one, which might seem kind of surprising, was a class I took from, unfortunately now deceased, Father Thomas King, who was a Jesuit at Georgetown. And because you're at a Jesuit school, you have to take two semesters of theology. And Father King taught a class on Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, the French Jesuit paleontologist. And one of the first things we did in that class was go all as a class with Father King down to the Smithsonian, to the Natural History Museum. So I think those three things, John McNeil's history class on the sort of meeting of East and West, Father King's theology class, but really about the writings and the life of Teilhard de Chardin, and then finally coming together with realizing that I could do this science, technology, international affairs major and sort of combine these interests and gave me a sort of view for where I could go.
I guess at the same time, if I have my approximate dates right, Bill Ruderman would have been talking about his early Anthropocene ideas.
Yeah, I don't think I was really aware of that yet. I graduate from Georgetown in 1998, which is the same year that Mann Bradley Hughes published this first hockey stick. All this stuff was sort of swirling. The IPCC, you know, report is in the works, and I don't know that I was fully aware of that yet. I think I was still operating in a fairly small awareness of the larger sort of climate change, but also human and environment discussions. You know, I was sort of aware of it in the Maya world because that was my sort of entry into it. But I was just starting to be introduced to this broader community.
Was that around the time when people were debating the classical Mayan collapse and the role of possible climate variations and that collapse, or if there even was a collapse?
Yeah, definitely. So this is one of the first things I become sort of aware of, right, is that there are these, the Florida group, Hodel and Brenner and Jason Curtis are putting forward these lake sediment records. The archaeologists are still, you know, having these debates about what is collapse, what collapsed, what does the pattern of collapse mean, you know, and all these discussions are definitely happening. So I step into this environment mostly through the archaeology side. So Tim Beach is a geoarchaeologist, soil scientist, geographer by training, but was working in these interdisciplinary teams, mostly led by archaeologists. So the late Bruce Dahlin, who was at Howard University, Tracy Arden, who's now at Miami, but I think was at Yale at the time. So I enter into this, Scott Hudson, who's at Kentucky now, was at Berkeley. I enter into this community where people are both excavators and looking at landscape scale and understand soils and geology, but are also archaeologists and understanding cultural context, which they're investigating. So it was actually really a great way to find yourself, find your way into this community.
So I'll wildly exaggerate the nature of the debate between these two communities. But as I understand it, there's at least a big chunk of the archaeological community that says, you know, when you really get down and look at the evidence from, in particular, things like ceramics, you see an incredibly heterogeneous development of Mayan civilization, but nothing even resembling a systemic collapse. Whereas the climatologists will come out from the point of view where they have these more broad scale indicators from, in particular, speleothems and tree rings, and trying to make the argument from potentially quite distant sites that there actually is a strong imprint of climate variability on a putative Mayan classical civilization collapse. Where do you weigh in on those issues? To what degree am I exaggerating? Is this actually a debate, and where is it right now, do you think?
Yeah, I think that's pretty accurate. The reason to think there's a collapse is that this civilization that's been building these monumental sites and particularly having this language, you know, a written language, stops building, or at least stops putting dates on, or stops recording the sort of building of these pyramids, these sites. Right at the same time, there appears to be some signs in these lake sediments at first, but now from speleothems and other lines of evidence of some sort of large climatic event, probably a drought of some sort. Yeah, and so, you know, one of the first things that I remember someone saying to me, it was probably Tracy and Bruce together, was, you know, being in Yucatan, and maybe I'm skipping ahead, but I got to go and spend 2 summers in Yucatan at a Maya excavation. One of the first things they said is, you know, well, I mean, the Maya didn't go away. You're amongst them right now. Right. So this whole idea of this, you know, collapse can be taken to this extreme. Obviously, the descendants of the ancient Maya live on these landscapes today.
In contrast to, let's say, the Anasazi collapse, where there was a mass migration to the Rio Grande Pueblos.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think this gets into questions of what do we mean by collapse. And I've encountered this now multiple times in my own research, as my paleoclimate work has touched upon archaeology or history, is what do we even mean by collapse? And I think maybe that's not at the root of this, but that's an important discussion to have. It's like, what are we actually talking about? What are the cultural transformations that actually occur? And I think it's possible for paleoclimatologists to come at this from a top-down sort of way and say, well, you know, everybody's gone, or, you know, there's bodies in the streets, or what have you. And the process of collapse or the evidence of collapse is seldom that, right? And like you said, migration or cultural changes, these are often the way these things happen. And there's always a danger in looking at a climate event that you see in your paleoclimate record and looking at something in history and coming up with the decision that these two things are sort of directly and maybe simply related, when often you scratch the surface or you talk to the specialists, to the archaeologists, the historians, there's a whole set of cultural, economic, political, geographic things that are going on that may or may not be important or may or may not interact with that climate event. And so, you know, this idea of collapse and even cultural change as it relates to climate is much more complicated than it often is when you've got your first new paleoclimate record and you look at it and you go, yeah, wow, that lines up with something that we think is important.
Now, let me get even further off track here and kind of like get into like Nature editorial decisions. When we usually don't send those kind of papers out to review on the possible strength of this link between a paleoclimate indicator and civilization, it can be like a nice bonus, but if that's the main pitch for a paper, we usually don't go forward unless they're actually able to take into consideration the sort of social systems, and in particular the food production and food security systems that might actually be at the heart of this. But it seems like that modeling community working with the paleoclimate records and robust statistics is actually kind of growing. I mean, it's small, but it seems to be happening. What's your perspective? Is that moving forward in a productive way? Is it really totally gestational? Where is that field right now?
Yeah, I think that's where we're headed, with some sort of fits and starts. But I think we're heading in that direction where there's a couple things happening. There's less inclination. I won't say there's none, but there's less inclination for paleoclimatologists alone to say, I've got this record and I'm going to look at the sort of simple version of history or events in history and align these two things and try and publish this just us.
That tends to really annoy the archaeologists.
Oh yeah, and understandably, completely understandably. You know, people that have this domain knowledge and often a career's worth of querying, you know, the facts and the evidence to suddenly sort of have someone, you know, come over and say, oh, well, I've got this figured out. So I think we're pretty rapidly moving away from that. So in the work I've been involved with, for instance, in Mongolia, the work led by Amy Hessel at West Virginia, Neil Peterson at Harvard, and one of the real key people of that team is Nicola DeCosmo from the Institute for Advanced Studies, a historian of this time period and of this region.
Where is that located, the Institute for Advanced Studies?
Oh, in Princeton.
Oh, in Princeton, okay.
And then where we've worked in Southeast Asia, in the Khmer Empire and Angkor specifically, but more broadly, the different civilizations that are there, working with the Greater Angkor Project at the University of Sydney. So Dan Penny in particular, and Roland Fletcher, Damien Evans, and their team. Again, right from the word go, you know, before you've already sort of come to this conclusion about how climate and history have interacted, bring these teams together, make sure that you're drawing on each other's knowledge and can debate and discuss what these sort of eco-facts or these paleoclimate data say about and interact with the social and economic and material culture.
I guess for that kind of interaction, probably one of the first things you really have to do is just get these big definitional questions on the table. Like, what do these communities mean by collapse? How does that discussion take? I mean, does it take the form of an argument when they begin, or is it more just like, okay, we need to figure this out?
Yeah, you know, I think the first hard thing is even developing these teams. And so one way is to, you know, say who works in this area. Let's get in touch with them.
Just cold call them.
Cold call them, right? And sometimes that works. But you also need people that can actually sit in the room together and, as you say, figure out a way to have these discussions and discuss the different lines of evidence. So it's more than just identifying the person based on their specialty. It's also finding a team that works well together and can communicate these things. And
so, I mean, you have to go and hang out at their meetings probably.
That definitely helps, getting invited to their meetings, having them to your meetings. So Nicola came in the field with us. Nicola de Cosmo came in the field with us in Mongolia. We got to go around Angkor with Roland Fletcher and with Dan Penny, so that we got to see the site from their point of view. So yeah, really intermeshing your methodology, your perspective on the landscape, be it the natural landscape or the ancient built environment that you're exploring. You know, having those conversations and the conversations take place over years.
Yeah, nothing moves quickly, right?
Nothing moves quickly. And that's because you're gathering different types of data, and this is a real progression. And sometimes that doesn't fit with how are we going to figure this out and within the space of a 3 or 5 year, say, NSF proposal. So I think the fact that the whole community that does this, I think, is moving in this direction of more integrative collaboration that is more of a sort of from the ground up, as opposed to saying, hey, we should probably talk to each other years after we've both been sort of publishing on this, I think is the way to go. And then the thing you're mentioning is the how do you actually integrate these data? And I think, you know, that's something we're all still working on. How do you take these paleoclimate data, which are at a certain scale with a certain type of uncertainty with certain resolution, both in space and time, and then integrate that with the archaeological or historical data, which can take a lot of different forms. Both in the Maya and the Khmer Angkor case, these collapses or cultural changes are occurring at a time where this writing isn't taking place, or the written records are from external sources. So in the case of the Khmer, from Chinese sources. And also, you know, sometimes some of the stuff is not reliable. So some of the writing that occurs after the fact at the collapse of Angkor has been called into question because the people that were writing it had motivations for writing in a certain way. So right. How do you integrate these different types of data? And I think that's the real question. And so one thing we've been doing, and really thanks to Jed Kaplan, who is a land surface modeler, but also has been really interested in actually trying to model how humans use landscapes, and then in turn, how are they constrained by resources and how the environment determines or at least influences carrying capacity. And, you know, Jed's worked with Bill Ruddiman on this. And so we're now trying to see, can we actually have a modeling framework that integrates the paleoclimate data with its uncertainty and the knowledge we have from history or from archaeology to look at how climate variability or climate change or events in the climate record ripple through, affect, or don't affect human societies in the past. And I think that's actually the real, I mean, there's a lot of interesting questions here, but one that's always tough to get at is, okay, sometimes we look at our records and there's this climate event or climate variability, drought.
And nothing happens.
Nothing happens, right. And so how do you understand when things don't happen? And that doesn't get as much attention, right? Like what gets attention is collapse and giant migrations and, mm-hmm. and all these sort of real attention getting events in the archaeological or historical record. But equally, and perhaps more important for our sort of modern condition is why did nothing happen? You know, if I can say we as this sort of community of paleoclimatologists, mm-hmm. geographers, archaeologists, historians, ethnographers, this whole community that's sort of interested in the interaction between environment and past human societies, I'd like to think that we're sort of on this track towards a way of integrating these two data sources that that does both of them justice and gets away from the sort of special case of collapse.
It's funny you mentioned Judd. I was just going to bring him up because I was at a meeting on the Asian monsoon with him. I guess it was maybe a couple of years ago now. It was the Chapman Conference in Hong Kong. And I think during one of the Q&As, he made the comment that, you know, we people do talk about the implications of what we're doing in these past reconstructions for modern resilience or modern collapses. But, you know, for me, mostly why I'm doing this, because I think it's just super interesting and I think it's really fun. You know, for you personally, not as the whole field, what is your motivation for doing this kind of work? There's obviously amazing basic science questions involved here, but people do talk a lot about this sort of work in relation to modern resilience or the lack thereof. And how do you address that kind of the classic paleoclimate question of to what degree does what we've seen in the past in Angkor or with the Mayans or with Mesoamerica, how does this, if at all, infer our understanding of our modern societies?
Yeah. So, I mean, I take myself back to this moment where I'm in the Yucatan and I was helping, or at least not getting in the way of these excavations and standing there and looking around this landscape. And I remember going like, what did this look like 1,000 years ago? Both the human environment, but was it wetter? Was it a better place to grow maize and to carry out agriculture on a large scale? And I remember that really sticking with me. And that, I think that was the sort of moment where I probably started down this path. And I mean, what was I thinking? I was thinking, this is super cool. And I wonder what happened. And that's a powerful motivation. And you stand there at Angkor and you look at this water infrastructure, this hydraulic city, and you go, this is amazing. You know, and why weren't they more resilient? Why does this civilization, why does this empire go through this really sort of major transition? So there's this curiosity-driven part of it. There's this just big questions in history and paleoclimate that you want to be able to try and answer. And so then the question becomes, and it's a question we ask ourselves in paleoclimate too, but extends to this sort of human environment and the past interaction is, well, how relevant is this to sort of future climate change? And yeah. I think that takes more almost of a theoretical than sort of practical, right? I mean, the way the Roman Empire or the way the Khmer at Angkor responded to climate change is obviously materially different than the way we will respond to climate change in the future, right? I mean, the technology is obviously different. We have vastly different global systems that we're interacting with. So, but what are the common questions? I mean, what are the things that we can still ask? Well, what makes a society resilient? And we can generalize that. Is it interconnections with other societies or within itself? Mm-hmm. Is it some aspect of building a infrastructure that is flexible or becomes brittle, as we think probably what happened at Angkor, that you may have an amazing infrastructure built to deal with one type of event, but then when you get a different type of event, say flooding or a multi-year drought, do you suddenly find that this vast infrastructure is not flexible, but is rather brittle and prone to certain types of disruptions. And so these questions generalize to a theory of vulnerability or resilience and what it is that makes a society or a civilization or an infrastructure, a way of life, either resilient or vulnerable to variability, timescales of variability, trends. So I think, you know, and this is where the modeling I described will come in and hopefully help us talk about these things in a way that's not so fixed to a particular material culture or a particular technology or a particular time in global history, but rather what can we take away generally about what makes a society either vulnerable or resilient? And does that have some lessons for us going forward?
But would you say that at this point, the answer to that question is unknown?
I think we're still working on that. Yeah. I mean, I think there's hints that come to us from prehistory, Angkor being an example of, you can have this wonderful infrastructure, but if you don't maintain it, or if it was constructed for a different type of disruption or anomaly, you may find yourself with something that's a liability for either actual sort of physical hydraulic reasons or for political economic reasons. That there's a population that has come to expect that this infrastructure will be maintained, that it'll be available to them. So I think there's hints that come out of these sort of places we've been able to look at this, but sort of a general theory of resilience and vulnerability is something I think that we're all sort of working towards.
That'd be a great Nature paper, by the way.
Hey, I'm writing that down.
Wait, once you have that done.
Giant theory of resilience and vulnerability.
So let's turn to another raging controversy that you were involved with. You did your master's in Tennessee, as you mentioned, but then you went to Arizona for your PhD, graduated there 2007. And of course, that's one of the great places in the world for doing dendrochronology, but late in your PhD, there was a paper published in Nature in 2006, and it made the claim that the collapse of the Monteverde Golden Toad was being driven by climate change. And so, this is now, 11 years ago, this is one of the early claims that specifically said climate change is causing an extinction or a collapse of a specific, fairly iconic species. But then in 2010, you had a paper in PNAS that was looking at, as I recall, isotopic evidence in trees, not actually in tree rings, but from tropical trees, that was making a counter argument against this paper, as I think other papers have done as well. So can you talk through how that paper first struck you, and then your pathway to this isotopic analysis that seemed to refute some of these claims?
Yeah. So I lived in Costa Rica for a year in 1996, 1997, and so was aware of the extinction of the golden toad, Monteverde golden toad, in the cloud forests of Costa Rica, mm-hmm. as one of these examples of climate change already claiming a species via extinction. And sadly, since the last golden toad was seen in the late 80s, it has not reappeared. Hope dwindles that someone might find a population of it. So flash forward to my PhD at Arizona, and I'm looking for sites to do tropical dendrochronology using stable oxygen isotopes. And one thing that Mike Evans, who was my mentor, he's now at University of Maryland, and I had already noticed, was one of the challenges to doing this was when trees shut down, you might miss part of the annual oxygen isotope cycle in these trees. As I was designing my PhD, I was thinking, okay, well, in cloud forests, it's possible that it's always wet enough, even in this wet, dry tropics that we see in Central America, that the trees might grow year-round and that there might be this sort of continuous isotope signal that we could extract and draw on.
So just from the annual cycle of oxygen, you could be picking up like a proxy for a visible tree ring, essentially, and from that data.
Yeah, exactly. So this was work that was pioneered by Mike Evans and Dan Schrag at Harvard when Mike was a postdoc at Harvard. And essentially the idea was this, that over the course of the year in tropical environments, there might not be the climate signals for trees to form rings, but what they are doing is using water with distinct isotopic signature. So the rainy season has a much more depleted oxygen isotope signal than right. the dry signal. And so my extension of it to cloud forest was that cloud water has a much more enriched oxygen isotope signal than rainfall. And that the possibility existed here, even in trees that were growing year round and had no visible annual rings, that they actually were recording time. But mm-hmm. it was in the oxygen isotope signal in the alternating rainy and fog seasons. And that this sort of ever wet environment in these mountain locations in Central America would give you the conditions where the tree would grow consistently, but also have this varying use of water with distinct oxygen isotope signatures. And so as I sort of started looking at cloud forest environments, Costa Rica and Monteverde became the one that sort of met all these requirements, some meteorological data and various other things I was looking for. And so I decided that Monteverde would be the site for my dissertation. And of course, also here was this opportunity to actually look at a long-term record of this climate change that had been said was the cause of this extinction, and not just the extinction, but also rising cloud-based heights. And there were concerns about, you know, how species would respond to higher temperatures and reduced immersion in the clouds. Obviously, these environments are really tightly coupled, and these species that grow there and the types of plant and animal communities you find there are tightly controlled by this availability of sort of consistent fog during the dry season. So so I went to Costa Rica and spent a couple field seasons in Monteverde, found some trees growing high up in the cloud forest that were old and continuous growing, and was able to extract these oxygen isotope time series. And my expectation was that I would see this progressive sort of decline in fog immersion, that there would be sort of greater evaporative stress on and modification of the water isotopes, and that this would be something that would be seen in my long-term record, and that this would sort of support this shorter-term interpretation from the limited data that was there from instrumental records.
Yeah.
So, develop all the data, you know, months and months on the mass spectrometer, and I'm analyzing these data, and there's no long-term trend. There were basically two things that popped out of this record: multi-decadal variability, which we linked to changes in the Pacific and the Atlantic Ocean at these timescales, and then an ENSO signal, an El Nino signal. And what's interesting, what I noticed was that it was actually the El Nino of 86, 87 or so, which is when the Monteverde golden toad went extinct. That was when they were last seen in great numbers, corresponded to actually one of the driest dry seasons. In fact, I think it was the driest dry season.
Well, that wasn't a huge El Nino, was it?
No, it wasn't the biggest one. But it was sort of long-lasting. And when you look at the records, it seemed to have had the most sort of persistent effect on Costa Rica during the dry season. So there were other stronger El Ninos, but it was something about the anomalies that were seen during that sort of, it was sort of a weird El Nino, if you remember. It sort of wasn't the sort of canonical 97, 98 or 82, 83. It was sort of a strange one. It had a different sort of seasonal timing. The anomalies were slightly different. But that was the year, at least from the isotopes point of view, that was the driest. So no long-term trend, but this drying that was associated with El Nino. And so our interpretation of that data was that if there was a climatic cause or a climatic contribution to the extinction of the Monteverde golden toad, it was how dry it got during that 86-87 event. And then probably, this seems very likely, the presence of this fungus, this parasite that's killing amphibians throughout the Americas. That was our hypothesis. And that it wasn't, at least yet, something that could be said to be related to sort of long-term trends in temperature.
I think that is part of a huge body of literature that's ever growing, showing the magnitude of internal variability in, well, pretty much everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious, you know, when you published that, obviously the paper Nature had been cited both in the literature, but also in the media. Mm-hmm. When you come out and say something like, well, you know, this wasn't climate change. This was variability associated with an interesting El Nino superimposed upon a fungal outbreak common to many amphibians. Did you get any blowback from any part of the community that was perhaps philosophically invested in the idea that climate change was wreaking havoc in biological systems?
Yeah, I definitely had some sort of not very nice emails sitting in my inbox. There was some sort of public pushback from some people that believed that it was global warming, so it was the increase in temperature. My paper sort of came out at the same time as a few others where people had been investigating this question from different angles. So one was sort of looking at the spread of this fungal pathogen in space and really noticing that, you know, this sort of spatial spread of this pathogen and its arrival in Costa Rica and Panama sort of corresponds to this extinction. So I wasn't alone in saying this. It wasn't as much of a storm as I might have expected. I upset some people that I wish I hadn't.
What did they disown you or just express disappointment, or was it more on a personal or scientific level?
I think it was a little bit of everything. That they still believed that it was this temperature trend, that, you know, they wished I had talked to them more. But, you know, these were our findings and these were our results, and they were supported by other sort of lines of evidence. And I think, you know, one thing to take away from this is really this idea of, as you said, the potential for natural variability to, in concert with other things like this fungal pathogen, which was almost certainly introduced to the Americas, you know, by humans. that we have other ways that we're interacting with climate variability, and we have other ways that we're endangering environments and species.
One thing that's struck me about your work is that you have this interest in very specific stories, like the Monteverde golden toad or anger, for example. But you also have an interest in these broader scale reconstructions. Right now, I think you're involved in this ongoing project called In Trend, trying to do Northern Hemisphere reconstructions. How do you find yourself being drawn in terms of your personal interest to looking at specific stories versus trying to work on broader continental to hemispheric scale reconstructions of past climate variability?
Yeah, I think the two things are linked in the sense that the spatial context and the spatial information we get from doing these large scale reconstructions, particularly these climate field reconstructions, so drought atlases or hemisphere scale reconstructions of not only, you know, the hemisphere or global average, but also what it looks like in space. This gives us a lot of context that we wouldn't get from, and we don't get from, just sort of point estimates of past climate. So I think there is this link between being interested in particular time periods and events and phenomena and doing these large-scale reconstructions. And, I different times in my career have been inspired and motivated and mentored and by different people. And in terms of that spatial reconstruction, Mike Evans, who not only is an isotope geochemist, I'm a paleoclimatologist, but also applied mathematician.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So he when he was at Lamont Doherty, worked with Mark Kane and Alexei Kaplan doing large-scale reconstructions. And so that was one of these inspirations. And then going to do a postdoc with Ed Cook, the legendary dendroclimatologist and one of the people that's done most to sort of advance our knowledge of spatial climate variability, particularly for drought. So, you know, having both of these as mentors, PhD and postdoc, really inspired me to do this kind of work. And oftentimes, once you've done this work, it then provide some information about these human environment stories. So the drought atlas has obviously been used quite a bit to inform, particularly in North America, cultural changes. And we've done the same thing in monsoon Asia. Ben Cook led a paper where we looked at this in terms of the Mediterranean just recently and put the sort of recent droughts in the Mediterranean in this long-term context in space and time, but also this new end trend. So we've been working as part of a past global changes consortium on volcanic impacts, climate, and society. And once you have these reconstructions of climate in both space and time, you can actually go look at what was the response of the Northern Hemisphere temperature to these volcanic eruptions, and not just sort of in the average, but actually look at where, say, you've got written records, chronicles, or other archaeological and historical information. The two things are complementary. You know, obviously, these spatial reconstructions can also be used more in the formal sense of detection and attribution of the influence of different radiative forcing on climate change, or to look at the spatial and component of how we transition from the medieval warm period to the Little Ice Age. It also feeds into this idea of looking at what were the climate conditions that people were encountering over the last 2,000 years or so.
Volcanism is a fascinating story. I'm not a specialist, obviously, but it seems to me that, let's say, a couple of decades ago, it's fairly qualitative work people were looking at, often tree-ring width after major volcanic eruptions and seeing this general cooling pattern. But since then, a lot of things have happened in terms of the carbon-14 spike, I think, whatever, 746, and then the use of cosmogenic isotopes and ice cores. And as you say, I think really the rediscovery of all the archival records, and there's an explosion of interest in volcanism and its effect on climate. It seems to me in the past 5 years, just looking at kind of submissions to Nature, what's your sense of what drove that reinvigoration of interest, if that's what happened in the first place? And what are the emerging findings that are coming out of this renewed interest?
It does seem to come sort of in waves. I don't know what necessarily set this recent wave off. I think there was a couple things. One was this growing awareness of the sort of mismatch between what climate reconstructions of the last millennium were saying about the response to volcanism and what climate models wanted to say about the response of volcanism. And this is enabled by having these last millennium climate simulations. And so you know, for a while we had two, like last millennium climate models, right? We had
it's not a lot of degrees of freedom, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And they were sort of lower resolution but you know, so people were looking at these and saying, well, the one thing that these models really want to do in response to what we think the volcanic forcing was, particularly around large eruptions like 1257, for instance, is really cool a lot. Cool the hemisphere, cool the mm-hmm. globe a lot. And the reconstructions don't support that magnitude of cooling. So mm-hmm. that sort of mismatch that was becoming more obvious as last millennium climate model simulations were done and more reconstructions of global and hemisphere temperature over that same timescale were done, I think probably spurred some of this interest. I sort of came to this question accidentally. I was mostly a drought specialist. But one of the other things I've done is forward modeling of tree ring proxies. So actually trying to understand how tree ring width proxies in particular are formed by the sort of seasonal combination of temperature and precipitation limitation.
Right, right.
And so this sort of became involved in, or this question of how trees actually record these climate signals became important when thinking about what might be the reason for the difference between models and proxies in this regard. And I think at the same time, there's been other things going on, and whether this is coincidence or motivated by one or the other, I don't know. But for instance, you know, Michael Sigel and his colleagues in the sort of new chronology for volcanic eruptions, and Michael working with others, including Matt Tui, on translating these new ice core records into radiative forcing. Mm-hmm. And as you said, the discovery of some of these really interesting transient radiocarbon events that give us these wonderful time markers in both the ice cores and the long tree ring chronology. So a bunch of things have been happening at the same time. And I also think what's going on is also in the historical and archaeological communities. At the same time that people have been sort of coming together to work on questions of the interaction between past societies and, say, drought or something like that, is also how past societies both responded to volcanic eruptions and the sort of climate events that followed, but also how they recorded them. And I think my colleague Francis Ludlow and others who have looked at sort of the written records of how people saw changes in the sky, or they witnessed the sort of mm-hmm. like actual evidence of these volcanic eruptions is really interesting. So a bunch of things have been happening all at once here on the climate end and at the ice core end, at the modeling and forcing end, and at the historical and archaeological end. So it's become this really exciting community to be a part of.
So, you know, going back to your professional career for a little bit, you have just gone through a pretty big change. And I was looking at your CV, and your current appointment at U of A is interesting because you're at the School of Geography and Development, but you're also jointly appointed to the Laboratory of Tree Ring Research, Department of Geosciences, and the Graduate Interdisciplinary Program in Global Change. Mm-hmm. Before that, you spent quite a bit of time at Woods Hole and then at Lamont, like going back to 2007. And I think somewhere along that time, you met Jessica Tierney, and the two of you have somehow managed to accomplish something that's really astonishingly rare in science, at least in my experience, which is having careers that are somewhat related, but actually managing to secure two professorships at a great university. You know, if you're comfortable doing so, I'm really curious about how you were able to navigate that, and if this multiple appointment at Arizona represents any kind of interesting negotiations that took place with the university.
You know, I wish I had, like, I'm happy to talk about it. I wish I had some formula to pass on to people to make this possible for everybody, because I know it's one of the really difficult things that, you know, academic couples go through is trying to find two positions that makes everybody happy and feel fulfilled and be in the same place.
I mean, you guys have published papers together, and I think universities might often have the reaction of, well, you know, we're going to get Jessica, so we're actually going to get half of Kevin's brain anyway. Why do we need to offer him a position?
No, I mean, we have been extremely fortunate. We do different enough things that it would be rare for someone to say, well, they do the same thing. And certainly Lamont and Woods Hole and Arizona are places with broad earth science and paleoenvironmental communities that are able to recognize that that we do different things, work on different timescales and environments. And yeah, our research interests have come together
from time to time.
I think we've got 3 or 4 papers together on different topics. But we've got this good mix of sort of, I think, complementary interests and also our own domains and our own proxies and things like that. So, yeah, I wish there was some larger formula I could take away from our good fortune.
I mean, I think every story like that is individual, and there is no general scheme that you could advance to anybody.
Yeah, we've been very fortunate. So I was at Lamont. Jess came there as a postdoc. Woods Hole was looking to hire several climate scientists at once, so there were multiple positions that were available. Mm-hmm. And then in coming here to Arizona, we entered a community in earth science, earth systems, water, climate, paleo community that is broad enough to welcome both of us in. So I'm in School of Geography and Development. She's in the Department of Geosciences. So we've been really fortunate in finding positions and universities where both of us are welcome with equal positions and we haven't really had to compromise. We've been incredibly fortunate.
Were the two positions open at the same time, or was it a dual career negotiation with the university?
This current one was a dual career negotiation, and people in the earth science and paleo community knew we were a couple, a package deal. So there was that was known right from the beginning.
Oh, it wasn't a surprise to them. Like, wait, what?
Exactly. It's like, I've got something to tell you. So that was known right off the bat. And in some ways that made it easier, because if there had been a signal that was like, no, there's no way this is possibly going to happen, then you can go, well, okay, you know, that's okay. We know that now, and we're not going to push that further. So, so it was nice that was sort of implicitly known.
When you got there, if I have the people right at this institution, there are people that are related to what you're doing, but are slightly off axis, like Jonathan Overpeck and Julie Cole, who are also a scientific couple. Mm-hmm. And I know that Peck has been advocating or sort of developing this broader sustainability initiatives there. When you got there and were exposed to those kinds of activities, I mean, did it broaden your scope of what you wanted to do professionally, or were you already doing those things, or do you see your work as being quite distinct from those activities?
This is a really sort of great university to be at for a number of reasons. One is this broad community, as I said, of people that are interested in water, ecosystems, climate change, paleoclimate, carbon and forests, and Arizona has these wonderfully low walls. So you can be in all these different departments and you see each other all the time and you collaborate. Your students hang out together. They're in classes together. It's this really great environment to be an earth scientist in. And so you really want to be part of that. And being here in the Southwest and seeing the sort of sustainability and environment issues around water, around ecosystems and fire linked to climate change, you want to jump in, you know, with both feet and see what you can do and what you can contribute to that. And there's already so many wonderful people in the tree ring world here working on it. So Connie Woodhouse, David Miko.
Is Valerie Truet there? I can't remember if she's there.
Yep. Valerie's here as well. Yep. But was thinking specifically about Connie and Dave's work on not only doing sort of river flow reconstructions, but also engaging very directly with water managers and natural resources managers in this actual sort of co-production of knowledge. So not so much paleoclimatologists going out, doing a reconstruction because they're interested in it, and then throwing it over the fence at the managers and saying, here you go, and, you know, walking away, or the sort of loading dock, I've heard it put, science, but...
I haven't heard that before. That's great.
You back the truck up, you dump all your paleoclimate information there and
like, enjoy.
Hope that somebody, you know, comes in and gets it from the loading dock.
Yeah.
But rather, you know, Connie and Dave really setting this, and they're not the only ones, but they're my lab neighbors and we share lab space. Seeing how they've been really engaged with managers and with policymakers, you know, it's the sort of thing that you're like, that's what I want to do. I want to make sure that, you know, while I'm sitting here in the Southwest and I may have research everywhere from the Mediterranean to Mongolia to New England to Guatemala, that I'm contributing to my local environment, my town, my state, my region, to find research that's involved in that. So I have a fantastic postdoc, Bethany Colthard. She and I, along with our collaborators at USGS, the Geological Survey, are trying to better understand snow variability, snow water variability in space and in time. So taking this field reconstruction approach to understanding snow And I think that's so important here in the West. We know that snow is this really critical component of our water supply, and that's true for human systems as well as ecosystems. So it's been really exciting to have Bethany here and to be working with the survey on that question. Feel like you're contributing to something that's happening right around you.
One other thing that really struck me about your move is that you've come from Woods Hole and Lamont, which, as I understand it, are entirely soft money institutions, to Arizona, which obviously is the university where you have probably a 9-month salary, but also teaching responsibilities, where I think you wouldn't have had that in your previous positions. How has the adjustment been for you?
Yeah, so at Lamont, I was lucky enough to teach in a really cool program that the university had called it was a master's in sustainability management. And it was a professional master's program with just a really fantastic, diverse group of students, but aimed at sort of a business approach to sustainability. So how do you incorporate issues and concepts and such of sustainability within business or government? So I did get to teach a climate science class there, but it was Monday nights for like 3 hours, right? And then I had the rest of my week to myself, and I had two wonderful TAs at the time. And so I got to teach, but I don't think I really knew or remembered what it was like to be in the Monday, Wednesday, Friday type of teaching. I teach 4 classes a year now.
Oh, wow. That's a big load.
It's a big load to go for, and to go essentially from almost nothing at Woods Hole to 2 and 2 here. And so it has been an adjustment. We've been here for 2 years now, and I'm just starting to feel like I've got my feet underneath me a little better, that I know what I'm doing, that I can manage it's essentially multiple deadlines every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday is what it feels like. So that's taken some adjustment. But on the other hand, it's just really, it's very rewarding to be in the classroom. And I've got some classes I really enjoy teaching for different reasons. I've got some great graduate students, and I really enjoy teaching those classes, but also the undergrads and some of these general education classes. It's just really, it's fun. It's really fun to sort of introduce them to these new concepts and to help them sort of engage with these questions about climate change.
Yeah.
And not just globally, but, again, here in the Southwest, what does it mean for us here? What does it actually mean for us here in Tucson?
I love being in the classroom, but I disliked essentially everything else about teaching. But one thing that I was experienced when every day when I went into the classroom to teach was a flare up of my imposter syndrome, which is, do I actually know what I'm about to go talk about for an hour and 15 minutes? Do you experience anything like that? Or do you get pre-class jitters, or do you just kind of go in with complete omniscience and confidence?
Yeah, somewhere in between. The jitters I've left behind, but I haven't taught any of these classes more than twice now. Even the second time around, you're like, right, I remember that this was like something that people asked about. So I've now like dug into it a bit and I got the answers. And that semester will be something completely different that people are like, but wait, what about that? And you're like, oh man. So, and you just got to say, you know what? I actually don't know the answer to that, but I'll go and find out and we can talk more about it. And you can also use it as, in the best cases, a teaching opportunity. So, well, let's talk about that. What do you think? Let's reason through this. I don't know the answer off the top of my head, but maybe as a class we can come up with it. But I know that I don't know it all, and that given enough time and enough students, they will find something that they're interested and curious about that maybe I haven't kept up with. So,
which makes teaching fun, right? That's the good part about it.
Yeah, and actually, it provides some additional motivation besides just curiosity to watching for the new stuff that comes out, or looking at the journalists that write really interesting things and making sure that I'm reading what they're doing, because it often gives you a glimpse into sort of what people will be interested in and what's on people's minds.
Kevin Anchikaitis from the University of Arizona, doing great tree ring research and forward modeling and work with climate modelers all over the world. Kevin, thanks so much for the chat today.
Michael, it's been fantastic. Thanks for having me.
That was my interview with Kevin Anchikaitis from the University of Arizona. Kevin, thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. If you'd like the show, you can subscribe to it through your favorite podcasting application, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, whatever it might be. It's nice because you'll get an email right away when a new episode is posted. I'm trying to do it every 2 weeks, like posting on Tuesday or Wednesday. I'm already a little bit behind schedule. This was a Wednesday. I was shooting for a Tuesday, but it's pretty close. If you'd like to get a hold of me, you can try me on Twitter @MWClimateSci or email forecastpod@gmail.com. The show notes are at forecastpod.org, and the opinions expressed here are mine and those of my guest, not necessarily those of Nature or Nature's publisher. Talk to you soon with either Jess Tierney or Julien Milger. I've also got interviews coming up, maybe with David Keith about geoengineering, possibly. That's not definite. And down the road, I'll have on Jerome Chabalaz talking about ice coring of all variety. And then later on, I'm looking at probably Julia Pontgratz and Marilyn Raphael, and then quite a bit in the future, a discussion about carbon cycling with Corinne LeCaire. Talk to you soon.